It's generally tomorrow around 6 to 8 degrees, but double figures in western Scotland and southeast England. More cool easterly breezes on Friday, more showers to come as well, and then a southeasterly wind will lift the temperatures as we head into the weekend.
All right, many thanks, Darren Bett. Simon Russell Beale reads a third episode of Ben McIntyre's A Spy Among Friends. The year is 1951. Kim Philby is in the Telex room at the British Embassy in Washington.
Kim, we've just decoded a top-secret telegram from London. It's bad news. The bird has flown.
What bird? Not Donald MacLean.
Yes, but there's worse than that. Guy Burgess has gone with him.
When that long, coded telegram marked top secret arrived at the British Embassy in Washington, Kim Philby's alarm was genuine. Guy Burgess had been his house guest until a few weeks previously. Philby was one of the few people apprised of the CIA's secret investigation into serious security leaks and in a position to warn Donald MacLean. All three had been at Cambridge together. It was only a matter of time before MI5 started digging into his past. Philby had to move fast. At lunchtime, he announced he was going home for a stiff drink. There he headed down to the basement, where he retrieved from a hiding place the Russian camera, tripod and film given to him by the KGB. He sealed the lot in waterproof containers and placed them in the boot of his car. Then he drove north to Great Falls in the Potomac Valley, where his friend James Angleton had often taken him fishing. On the deserted stretch, Philby parked, extracted the containers and a trowel, and headed into the trees. After a few minutes, he emerged and casually drove home. Somewhere in a shallow hole in the woods beside the Potomac still lies a cache of Soviet photographic equipment. If Philby was going to make his escape and join Burgess and MacLean in exile, now was the moment. But he decided to stay and try to bluff it out. No one had identified him as Agent Stanley or suspected he was the third man. The very act of staying put would suggest a clear conscience. Philby knew he could rely on his friends to defend him, and two above all, James Angleton of the CIA and Nicholas Elliott of MI6. Philby was summoned to London to discuss the disappearance of Burgess and MacLean. Before leaving, Philby made the rounds of his CIA and FBI contacts once more and detected no overt suspicion. Angleton seemed as friendly as ever. On the 11th of June 1951, Philby boarded the plane to London. He would never see America or Jim Angleton again. The disappearing diplomats had provoked a major sensation in Washington. The first report to arrive on the CIA chief's desk came from Bill Harvey of Counterintelligence. It was, in effect, a denunciation of Philby. Harvey drew together the strands of evidence with devastating precision. Taken together, he argued, they pointed to only one conclusion.
Philby is a Soviet spy.
The second report stood in stark contrast. Angleton explicitly rejected any suggestion that Philby might have been in league with Guy Burgess. In Angleton's estimation, Philby was no traitor, but an honest and brilliant man who had been cruelly duped by a friend. On the afternoon of the 12th of June, Kim Philby arrived at MI5 headquarters in London, feeling exhausted and apprehensive. He was greeted by Dick White, chief of counterintelligence, who, over the next few hours, would subject Philby to a grilling, thinly disguised as a friendly chat. Dick White was a decent man and a good administrator, but he was no interrogator. The question of Philby's own loyalty was never even mentioned. The meeting broke up with amicable handshakes. 2 days later, Philby was back in White's office, where the atmosphere was now several degrees chillier. A letter had arrived from the CIA, drafted by Bill Harvey, and with his indictment attached. It stated that under no circumstances would Philby be permitted to return to Washington.
In the State Department, repeated drunkenness, recurrent nervous breakdowns, sexual deviations and other human frailties are considered security hazards, and persons showing any one or more of them are summarily dismissed.
At the same time, the dossier on Philby was growing. Investigations had revealed his left-wing leanings at Cambridge and his first marriage to an Austrian communist. Dick White invited Philby to describe once again, but in more detail, exactly when he had met Burgess, what he knew of his politics, and how they had become friends. Philby was told to take his time. In the midst of a long, rambling answer, White realised with perfect certainty that Philby was lying. White suggested that MI6 take action as a matter of urgency. Philby was in deep danger. But he still had allies ready to support him, and one in particular whose loyalty remained as solid as it had ever been. Nicholas Elliot swiftly emerged as Philby's most doughty champion. Philby was his friend, his mentor, his ally. But Elliot's resolute defence could not save Philby's job. His friendship with Burgess, a Soviet spy, had rendered him useless for further work as an MI6 officer. Philby was now unemployed and under suspicion of treason. He knew he was being watched. The telephone was bugged and his mail was intercepted. But the eavesdroppers could find no evidence that he was in contact with the Soviets. Nicholas Elliot called often. His conversations with both Philby and his wife Aileen were carefully logged. One of these sent a sharp jolt of alarm through MI5 when Aileen was overheard telling Elliot that Philby had gone sailing with a friend, a city businessman with a yacht moored in Chichester on the south coast. Aileen asked Elliot if Philby was doing a diss, apparently fearful that her husband might use the boat trip to stage a disappearing act, like Burgess and McLean, and slip over to France. MI5 pondered whether to intercept the sailing party, but concluded it was already too late to stop him getting onto the yacht. Philby returned home that evening, oblivious to the flap he had caused. And that is how the strange case of Kim Philby remained for months and then years. A bubbling, unsolved mystery, still entirely unknown to the public. With 5 children, 1 unstable wife, and 2 major drinking habits to support, Philby needed money. Nick Elliot again came to the rescue, paying the children's school fees and persuading a loyal ex-colleague from MI6 to give him a job in his import-export firm selling castor oil and oranges. The salary was a meagre £600 a year. Philby commuted, miserably, to an office in London. He was out in the cold, as never before. Then, in August 1954, Vladimir Petrov defected in Australia. Petrov was a KGB colonel and the resident of the Soviet embassy in Canberra. As the highest-ranking defector since the war, Petrov brought a mass of information on ciphers, agent networks, some 600 KGB officers working as diplomats around the world. He also furnished the first hard evidence that the defectors Burgess and McLean were indeed in the Soviet Union and living in Kuibyshev. Even more explosively, he confirmed that they had been tipped off to escape by another British official, a third man. On the 18th of September, the People newspaper printed a series of dramatic revelations. Burgess and McLean had both been recruited as Soviet agents while students at Cambridge. These were not missing diplomats, as the government had maintained for so long, but spies on the run. Harold Macmillan, the new Foreign Secretary, faced a major crisis.
We are going to have to say something.
The government issued an 8-page white paper purporting to explain the Burgess and McLean affair. It was a peculiar mixture of half-truth and evasion that played down the scandal and made no mention of Kim Philby. It was dismissed as a cover-up. Just over a week later, the Philby family awoke to find their home surrounded by a pack of journalists in full hue and cry. That morning in New York, the Sunday News had run a story naming Philby as the third man, the tipster who had helped the defectors to flee. This was the work of J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, who had leaked Philby's name to a tame journalist to force the British into launching a full judicial investigation. On Tuesday, the 25th of October, 1954, on the London Underground train heading home, Kim Philby's eyes idly wandered to the front page headline of the Evening Standard. Dubious third man activities of Mr. Harold Philby. After more than 2 decades in hiding, Kim Philby had been flushed into the open. Once home, he immediately called Nick Elliot.
My name is in the newspapers. I have to do something.
Elliot's advice was to say nothing, ride out the storm, and allow his friends in MI6 to go to work on his behalf. The government had promised to make a statement and hold a debate. Elliot now set to work ensuring that when Foreign Secretary Harold Macmillan came to speak, he would say the right thing. On the 7th of November, Macmillan rose in the House of Commons and made a statement that might have been written by Nicholas Elliot, and probably was.
Mr. Philby had communist associates during and after his university days, but no evidence has been found to show that he was responsible for warning Burgess or Maclean. While in government service, he carried out his duties ably and conscientiously. I have no reason to conclude that Mr. Philby has at any time betrayed the interests of this country, or to identify him with the so-called third man, if indeed there was one.
Philby now went in for the kill. He announced that he would be holding a press conference in his mother's Kensington flat the next morning. When Philby opened the door, he was greeted with gratifying proof of his new celebrity. The stairwell was packed with journalists from the world's press. Philby had prepared carefully. He wore a well-cut pinstripe suit, a sober and authoritative tie, and his most charming smile. The journalists trooped into his mother's sitting room. Flash bulbs popped. The television cameras rolled. What followed was a dramatic tour de force, a display of cool public dishonesty that few politicians or lawyers could match. Philby looked the world in the eye with a steady gaze and lied his head off. Footage of Philby's famous press conference is still used as a training tool by MI6, a masterclass in mendacity. An American journalist with NBC was delegated to ask the questions.
If there was a third man, were you in fact the third man?
No, I was not.
Do you think there was one?
No comment.
Mr. Philby, you yourself were asked to resign from the Foreign Office a few months after Burgess and Maclean disappeared. The Foreign Secretary said in the past you had communist associations. That is why you were asked to resign?
I was asked to resign because of an imprudent association.
That is your association with Burgess?
Correct.
What about the alleged communist associations? Can you say anything about them?
The last time I spoke to a communist, knowing him to be a communist, was sometime in 1934.
That implies that you have spoken to communists unknowingly and not known about it.
Well, I spoke to Burgess last in April or May 1951.
He gave you no idea that he was a communist at all?
Never.
Would you still regard Burgess, who lived with you for a while in Washington, as a friend of yours? How do you feel about him now?
I consider his actions deplorable, but on the subject of friendship, I'd prefer to say as little as possible, because it's very complicated.
The resulting press coverage contained no suggestion that Philby was anything other than an honest, upright government official brought down by his friendship with a secret communist and now definitively absolved. Philby's triumph was complete. Elliot was overjoyed at Philby's victory and the prospect of bringing his friend back into his old service. The following July 1955, Kim Philby's heart sank when Nicholas Elliot called him and asked him to come down to the firm. It was barely 7 months since Macmillan had cleared him of suspicion. Could it be that MI5 had already found fresh evidence?
Something unpleasant again?
Maybe just the opposite.
Nicholas Elliot had found time to demonstrate his own peculiarly durable brand of loyalty. He had done what he promised to do and what no one, including Philby, had believed was possible. He had engineered Philby's return to MI6.
A Spy Among Friends was written by Ben McIntyre and read by Simon Russell Beale. It continues tomorrow. Now here's Sailing By to take us to the shipping forecast.
Thank you.
Now on BBC Radio 4, it's time for the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday, the 27th of March. There are warnings of gales in Forties, Trafalgar and Fitzroy. The general synopsis at 1800. New lows expected North Biscay 1006, Northeast Trafalgar 1000 and 50 miles west of Southwest Fitzroy 1000 by 1800 Thursday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Sierra. Easterly or southeasterly, backing northeasterly 4 or 5, occasionally 6 at first. In South Viking, showers later, mainly good. South at Sierra, Forties, Cromarty 4th. Easterly or northeasterly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 at first in Forties, decreasing 4 at times later. Showers, good.